This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. God, family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got it. Wildlife Control Supplies, proven solutions for wildlife control, delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're in the ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company, have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you. Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it, fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light, sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dead camp. Shotgun toter, Republican voter. Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA. Cause this is what I say.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got.
Hello everybody, this is your host Clint Locklear for Trappin' Radio, and it's Veterans Day. And I want to, just say thanks to all my fellow brethren out there that knows what it means to put on face paint, ruck up, load airplanes, fly airplanes, go into danger, all that stuff that military does. I just wanted to say thank you very much. Also, I want everybody to realize something. If you know a Marine, I think they should get a little extra slap on the back this week. November 10th is the Marine Corps' birthday. And their first birthday was in 1775. So, you know, they get a little extra this Veterans Day, in my opinion. So if you see a veteran, slap him on the back. If you know him well, give him a hug. Buys gas, get him a dinner, you know, just tell him thanks, something, you know, just do something like that. And I just think it's well needed. It's just well needed. Now, I want to tell everybody about an experience I had last night. And I'm not going to ramble on this too much. But me and my wife went and saw a concert last night. And I've been to a lot of concerts. I mean, a lot of concerts. And, you know, I've seen Garth Brooks. I've seen, you know, AC/DC and Aerosmith. And we can go on about all the people I've seen. I saw the most amazing concert in my life last night. And if you ever go to one concert ever again, you need to make sure you go see Jamie Johnson. He doesn't play really big venues, which makes it a lot more special. You know, when you watch like the CMAs and you listen to the radio and stuff like that, most of those singers, and I'm, you know, there's a lot of good singers out there, and I'm not saying this on anything, but it's mostly sizzle. I mean, you go to a Garth Brooks concert, and I like Garth Brooks. I have for years. It's smoke and mirrors and cables and running around and slinging stuff around and choirs and big video screens. And I mean, it's all sizzle and a little bit of steak. With Jamie Johnson, he plops out a full ribeye tenderloin, and it's perfectly cooked. It is amazing. I'm telling you. You need to, even if you don't think you like Jamie Johnson, just to experience that would be unreal. I mean, it was, you felt like it was you and him. Everybody in that room felt that way. Light show, non-existent. Backdrop, non-existent. Clothes, non-existent. Dancer, smoke, wire, pyrotechnics, non-existent. It was nothing but the most amazing concert I've ever seen in my life. But there's a couple of things that happened last night, and I want to talk about one of them really quick. He also knew that it was Marine Corps' birthday, and he sang the, you know, song about Tripoli, you know, the Marine Corps song. And if you would have been there, he had Marines stand up that were in the crowd. It wasn't a big crowd. I bet there wasn't 2,000 people in this little arena he was playing in. So it wasn't like there was thousands of Marines standing up. There was one about five seats down from us. He had them stand up, happy birthday Marines and all that. And he sang that Marine song. And it was just, it was mind-blowing. And all I could think is, this is what America is. This is really America. You know, when I talk about Washington, D.C. not being America, it's not America, guys. It's not. I don't know why we give them any credence hardly whatsoever. And I know there's election and all that, and most guys are going to be happy with the results of that. I get that. But if you could have been there when he sang that song, which very few people there knew the words of, they've kind of heard it before, but there's enough people there, me included, that was singing that thing out loud too. If it would have been somebody, you know, like a liberal or even a Republican politician there from Washington, they would have felt what everybody else felt there, and they had probably been wetting their leg. Because the red, white, and blue was so electric in that place, and it was just infused in the air. I mean, I don't even know how to describe it. Now, if someone from ISIS or the Taliban or the Russian Spetsnaz or whatever was also were to walk in on that during that time, they would know instantly, without a doubt, unequivocally, no questions asked. If you want to come to the real America, you're a lamb that's getting ready to try to attack a lion. It was amazing. And Jamie Johnson, what is really neat, he didn't say 50 words the whole night. It was nothing but songs. But he did say one thing, and then he played a song, which I'm going to play. Now, I'm having technical problems. The internet, I guess everybody's home from Veterans Day, and internet's just like all screwed up. So I'm going to try to do this show, and it may be a little awkward at times because I've got to do it through the recorder and not through a file on my editing program. So it's not going to be quite as clear. But all he said was, there's election. You know, everybody knows we just had an election. And I think this sums it up. And I want to play you this. Again, not a place that someone that didn't know what America was, they would be extremely uncomfortable in this situation.
As I went walking at Rhythm Highway, I saw above me in the skyway, I saw below me a golden valley. This land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. This land was made for you and me. I roamed and rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts, while all around me a voice kept sounding, this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. This land was made for you and me. As I was walking, I saw a sign there, no trespassing. But on the other side, it didn't say nothing. That sign was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. This land was made for you and me.
Now, if you don't feel something from that, something's wrong with you. Now, with the election that came up, y'all all know that I'm not the hugest Trump supporter, but I will tell you the pride that I feel from this election. We told the Washington politicians to go to hell. We told the liberal elitist and all the overeducated eggheads, we don't care what they think anymore. And all the little wimpy, wussy college students right now that are riding in the streets and they're not going to have to do midterms because they're so distraught, we don't give a crap what you say. And all the children that are running around in America burning property and knocking out windows and causing all the problems with the riots, the children need to go sit down, shut up, and grow up. I think that's what this election did. We told them, as a whole, whatever your reasoning was as a whole of America, you do not own America yet. We still do. So that is, I mean, to me, especially with the election and going to that and feeling everything that there was at that show, it was freaking amazing. Now, because we've had like a 55-year long election going on, at the end of the show, we're going to have a little bit of humor again from Jamie Johnson. And I do want to warn you, if you have some little tykes and you don't want to have to describe a couple of words or what that means, if they're small, you may not want to listen. It's a hilarious song, and it's just a little humor break from all the seriousness that's been going on around everything that we've been seeing. So, you know, I just wanted to let you know that's coming up. So you definitely, if you've never heard this, it's going to be hard for you not to crack up. But we've got a couple, we got three things we're going to talk about today. I've got two of the call-ins where you do the MP file on your phone and just email it to me. And we're gonna discuss these really quick.
Hey, Clint, this is Gabe from Knoxville. I don't have a question as much as I have a topic I would like for you to discuss. I want to know your thoughts on the division I see in the outdoor community. I don't mean that there are people truly at odds. I just believe you can divide the community up into two distinct camps. For this discussion, let's call one the outdoorsman. I consider myself one of these. We're people who hunt, fish, trap, and gather. We eat what we kill and catch. And the trophies are a side effect of the pursuits, not the focus. Outdoorsmen are students of the ecosystem and have a deep love for all wilderness and wildlife, not just the quarry that they're after. On the other hand, sportsmen seem to specialize. They may only deer hunt or bass fish, but would never go squirrel hunting or trapping. Sportsmen seem to make a competition out of everything they're doing, whether it be fishing tournaments or biggest buck contests. Sportsmen are usually experts on the game they hunt, but not interested in much else. You wouldn't catch one picking morals, let's say. I wonder if you see these two groups like I do, and if you think there may be problems in the future because of their differences. And if you believe, as I do, that sportsmen are starting to outnumber outdoorsmen, and if you think that could be a bad thing for trapping. Since they don't tend to defend it, trapping that is, as vigorously as they defend hunting from the antis. Thanks for your show, and God bless.
That's a very interesting topic. I'm not sure that I've got the answer. It would be interesting, and I don't know if I've got the capability to do this, but if you were to get some serious bass fishermen, deer hunters, trappers, squirrel hunters, morel hunters, different things like that together and have a conversation about it, if they were influencers inside of their community, I think it could be very good. Now, when you look at somebody that does an awesome job of promoting outdoorsmen, it's Ted Nugent. Uncle Ted has got this down pat. And if you listen to him and he's talking, he gets all excited and he just doesn't, if he's deer hunting, he just doesn't talk about deer hunting, or if he's trapping, he just doesn't talk about trapping or whatever. I'm sure he fishes. I don't know if I've ever seen him or heard him talk about fish. We all know he loves guns. But when he talks, the language he uses, I think, is the key. Now, us as trappers, you know, we hear stuff like this, and we've heard it in our communities, you know, like instead of calling a foothold trap, you call it a foot restraint or something like that. And we automatically balk against that. And trust me, I know why. I understand why. But language with society makes a big difference. You know, it really does. You've seen it all through the election. And if Hillary would have understood language a little bit better, it would have been tougher for Trump. And if Trump would have understood language better than he did, which he doesn't, he would have absolutely mopped the floor with her so bad it would have been unbelievable. He would have had every one of Bernie Sanders' voters. But he didn't understand the language or how to use it correctly. And language is setting a tone. And when Ted Nugent talks about, you know, you need sport, you know, hunting, fishing, trapping, shooting, he puts it all under one umbrella most of the time. Now, sometimes he'll leave out trapping, or he'll leave out fishing, or leave out shooting, but he says it enough that everybody knows that watches him, that really gets into, you know, watching Ted Nugent, that he's for the outdoors. And he's always talking about the backstraps and this, that, and the other. And it's clear. Now he's done. He smacks some trophies. There's no doubt. But he gets just excited over killing a doe or a spike buck as he does over a trophy. It's clear. I mean, you know, he just loses his mind no matter what it is, because he's just so glad to be in the moment, so glad to be hunting, so glad to be in nature, so glad to be a participant of nature. You know, and that comes across. And I think, you know, one of the biggest things is the language that we need to figure out how to use as outdoorsmen or sportsmen. See, because either one of those words, depending on how you use it, can mean a lot of different things. Now, I know exactly what you mean by this. I've got a good friend, D. Scruggs, down in Whitwell. This is about 15 minutes from here. He's an older gentleman, and he used to run with me all the time when I was trapping beaver in Marion County. That man is a sportsman. I mean, he's an outdoorsman, and he is a sportsman. He likes to, you know, try to shoot bigger deer, but he gets just excited over seeing a doe, and half the time he won't shoot a bigger deer because he just enjoys watching it. But he's always putting meat on the ground, and after deer season, he's setting traps for friends. You know, he's going to pick blackberries. He's going fishing all the time. I mean, his life has always been amazing to me about his knowledge of the true outdoors and nature and all that. And that to me, when I think of me personally, of what we would consider probably an outdoorsman, that's D. Scruggs. And D's never going to hear this probably, but when people have questions about the weather, you know, like we're in this big drought right now here in Tennessee, water's drying up and all this. People are coming up to him asking him how it's going to affect the squirrels. He knows. He knows all that. And to me, that's a lot more interesting of an outdoorsman than being a specialist. It really is. You know, now what you're referring to as your specialist are more, they're like trophy hunters. You know, and I can understand that to a point. You know, when I was younger, I used to believe more in that. Like when I go deer hunting now, I was with Chip. We went down there last year and I shot a doe and hog. And Travis is, you know, he's 18 years old at the time. He got a great big old buck and he was all excited and this, that, and the other. And he's still waiting to get back from the taxidermist. And I mean, that was like the highlight of his life. And I've been talking to Travis, trying to get him to be more of an outdoorsman without the trophy mentality or sportsman mentality, because to me it's more enjoyable and it's more real. And there's when it's all said and done, it means more. Because once you kill a 14-point deer, now you got to go find a 15 or a bigger 14, and then the one you caught before didn't mean as much. Well, to me, you know, I don't even shoot anything with horns because I'm a meat hunter. And to me, they don't taste as good because of when they're in season and stuff like that. And I just let them go. And when I was down at Chip's, I've been trying to convince Travis, he doesn't have to be 40 feet up in a stand. As long as you understand deer. And I'm trying to get him to see the patterns, how deer work and where they go and all that type of stuff. And he's still kind of caught in the sportsman mentality of this. You got to have the perfect tree stand and the feed to get them in and the trail cams and the certain camouflage and the certain kind of bow and all that type thing. And I'm telling him it really doesn't matter because, you know, his granddad didn't have all that and he put plenty of deer on the ground. But I was at Chip's and Chip put me up in a stand. And you know, even though I jumped out of airplanes, rappelled out of helicopters, I love that. But you put me in a 20-foot stand with no security. And I don't like it at all. And Chip had me go up a desk stand on the next to the swamp. And when I got up there, it was like a little seat. It was like 12 inches wide and it was 18 inches deep. And there was nothing else up there. And I'm holding a 308. And I was afraid to move if a deer wasn't exactly where I could perfectly, you know, put it on my shoulder. Because I didn't want to, you know, come off of that thing. So I lost my nerve after like 20 minutes and came down. And I went up against the swamp with the wind to my face to where the deer trail was at. On the backside of me was nothing but water and stuff like that. And I'm sitting there for about 40 minutes. I'm not moving and everything. and this, I hear the water behind me start splashing, and here comes up in front of me about a 10-point buck. Nice. I mean, most people would like to have this thing on the wall. And my goal was to get a picture of it for Travis. Now, this thing, when this deer came around the edge of the swamp, he was on top of me. He was about 6 foot in front of me. And I had my cell phone out, and I thought I was recording. And when I moved my eyes down to see the screen, I could see that it wasn't recording. And he saw me move my thumb. Of course, he bolted out of there. But to me, that was the coolest thing in the world. And to me, that is the way that I look at wildlife. When I go trapping, you know, when I was younger and I was having to pay bills off, trapping numbers were it. Now I don't look at it quite the same, and I think that comes a lot with age, you know. And then you've got the sportsman, what you're calling a sportsman, that you know, they want the biggest fish, they want the biggest deer. It's almost like a bragging type thing, you know. Sometimes it's not, but a lot of times it is, and that's just a totally different mentality. But the language that we choose when we talk about the outdoors with others, I think will have a lot to do with it. And I think using the term outdoorsman is a lot more advantageous to the goal of everybody keeping their rights than sportsman. Because it covers, so if, you know, if we could get it, if we could get enough people like Ted, when they talked about the outdoors, hunting, fishing, trapping, you know, shooting, you know, canoeing, throw all of that in there, camping, all of that where it's food gathering, you know, all that under one tent, it would be a lot harder to mess with. Now, unfortunately, we're in, and we talked about this, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, I talked about the pendulum. Now, the pendulum, I know why he uses that term. I think it should be more like, you know, called the social mindset of the time, or the social swings, or something like that, instead of a pendulum, so it's a little bit more clear what it is. But the part of this pendulum or the social swings that we're in, the trapping, hunting, bow hunting, fishing, all that, I guarantee is in really big danger. Not because of anything that outdoorsmen are doing, but because of the pendulum that we're in. When you go all through history, from now, for about the next 10 to 15 years, is what the book refers to as it's time to burn witches. And you can see it in the election. You know, you can see it in politics. You can see there's a just a human development through this cycle. And patterns are part of nature. They're part of people. We think we're above all that, and apparently we're not, because this pattern keeps repeating itself. So you have a pattern where, you know, I'm not sure if I'm okay, but you're okay. And then you go back to, if you listen to music like Nirvana, everybody's trying to find themselves and do all that type stuff. And, you know, everybody then, it, you know, all of a sudden it goes into, I'm okay, you're okay. And, you know, and then it eventually gets to where we're at now, where it's, I'm okay and you're not okay. So just like a liberal, they think they're awesome and we need to be burned at the stake. And the same thing with conservatives. We're okay, we're awesome, and we need to burn you at the stake. Well, the same thing is happening right now, because that's the social part of this society swing that we're in. And I don't know if there's a way to break it. I really don't. Because, like I said, this has been going on all the way back, all the way through the biblical times, this swing. There's a reason that the Israelites stayed in the desert for 40 years. The reason was they were in the me part of the swing, and they were not going to go come together to help build Israel till they got out of that. That's the reason I think that they were in that 40 years. You see these 40 years a lot in the Bible. It's because of this swing thing. Now, as sportsmen, I think the trick, and it's not a trick like you're fooling somebody, but I think the way to handle this is, if we understand the swing that society's in, and that means I'm okay, you're not okay. And this can be for anything. You know, you've got you can even see this inside of trapping. You've got numbers trappers that are okay, and they don't understand the hobby trappers, and they're not okay. Why are they doing it? And then the hobby trappers are like, we're okay because we're doing it because we enjoy it. Why you got to try to make, why you got to turn it into some type of a game where you got to have more than everybody else or this, that, and the other. And you know, that I'm okay, you're not okay type thing. So if we know that, it seems like, you know, people do get smarter over time in a way. And if we know this cycle is going on, the only way that I can really see to switch that is to figure out a way where all of the outdoorsmen, including sportsmen, are okay and everybody else is not okay. Because the psychic of people in America, that's where they're at. I mean, you can name any topic you want to. You know, you've got like permaculture is okay and conventional farming is terrible and need to burn them at the stake. And conventional farmers think they're okay, and all of the alternative stuff is a joke and they just need to be, you know, thrown out and they're just screwing stuff up. You can break it down even further into something as simple as milk. You've got whole movements built on raw milk because raw milk is okay and pasteurized milk is not okay. And then you've got the pasteurized science, the side that's going, you know, people could get sick if we don't pasteurize, so we're okay. And all y'all nutbags that want raw milk and want people to be dying in the streets, y'all need to be prosecuted for it. And it's the same thing when it comes to hunting. The only way, like I said, the only way I can see this, man, really, to get through these next 10 or 15 years is to start using language and getting other people in other parts, like in the fishing and hunting industry, like Ted does, where what Ted's doing, I don't know if he's doing this on purpose or he's read the book or he's seen the pattern. I mean, he's a very intelligent guy. But what he's done is instead of separating hunting, shooting, fishing, and trapping, he's put that as we're okay and everybody else is screwed up. And it's very clear the way he talks, he thinks that. You know, they're like broke humans for not understanding this. And that would keep the outdoorsman strong. There's no doubt in my mind about that. It would keep the outdoorsman strong to do something like that. But I think it's going to be language. I also think for trapping and hunting to survive, we're going to have to be a little more cautious. And I'm not talking about being weak. Anybody knows me knows that that's not really in my vocabulary. I'm not talking about being weak. But if you could use terms when you're talking to non-trappers, especially other sportsmen, that they would understand where it would benefit them. They would see a better use of it. And the way most trappers talk about it, they, you know, someone says, well, you know, like a deer hunter. Well, yeah, I shoot a stick at 300 feet through an animal. And yeah, you know, there's a lot of blood trails and I got to track them. But that's more humane than what you're doing. You know, so see, they're saying I'm okay, you're not okay. We're saying I'm okay, you're not okay. And there's this separation. But if you can use, and if you look at the outdoor industry, it's coming around more to trapping than it ever has since I've been alive on a more mainstream. You see it on history channels and stuff like that. But more than that, when you look at Sports Afield and the QDMA magazines and the college studies and stuff like that, it's gearing more towards trapping is beneficial. So if we as trappers learn how to talk, if you're talking with a deer hunter, that they're going to have, you know, more deer because, you know, we all enjoy the outdoors, and our part of keeping everything right, you know, in balance is we keep the predators down so you have a better chance to, you know, hunt your deer, whether it's for meat or for horns. Now, see, that's a lot different than getting face to face with a deer hunter and going, I have as much right to be out here as you do. Go screw off, which is what happens most of the time. Now with the fishermen, it's the same thing. If they got ponds or they're on the river, like I can tell you around here, fishing has went way down since we've got otter because the fish populations are way down. if we talked about fishing more, as far as in the way we talked about our trapping, whether it be, you know, online or Facebook or anything else like that, where we could combine the two where they're beneficial, I think that would be a lot. And this may sound like I'm being political here, and it is in a way, but it's the only way that I can see, because we need to figure out how to put us in the we're okay group and then fight against the not okay group, which would be everybody that doesn't hunt. That's not going to understand, you know, for the most part. But see, this group is bigger than most trappers or hunters think it is. If you go look at the Weston Price Foundation, they have a podcast called Wise Traditions. Listen to that podcast, just a few of them. And you will see they are not against hunter-gatherer type people. That's what they want people to be again. If you look at CrossFit, which is a massive movement, probably as big or bigger than the hunting industry, they want wild meat. So if you could start making connections with people like that, now you're building the umbrella of we're okay bigger and more stronger and more confusing to the people that thinks it's not okay. So since we know that this swing of society is happening, we have to be intelligent enough as outdoorsmen or sportsmen or trappers or whatever you want to call it to envelop everything in here. You know, like it would like when people write online or they do YouTube videos or Facebook, you know, if more people would put in there, you know, the reason I'm trapping is because our deer numbers are going down and I want my brethren outdoorsmen to be able to enjoy their sport as much as I do. See, that's a totally different view when someone that may not hunt comes across that video or content in some way, because it puts it in a different light. And it's language. That's all it is language. You know, and if another way is you could start talking about the good old days, which is one of the things we're getting ready to get into heavy on the business course, is one of the things that we have to really understand on this new trend we're in for the next 10 or 15 years, is during this thing, people want, even if it wasn't better, they want to think that it was better in the past. And that's just historical fact. So if you're talking about trapping, you know, like we're out here trapping because we want, you know, we want the outdoors and the animal populations and stuff to be like it was in the good old days. You know, when deer hunters had bigger deer and more deer, and you know, we had more critters to trap, and I mean, it just changes what you have to figure out. And I mean, this is a lot bigger topic than we're going to fix on Trapping Radio, I promise you. But like with the NTA, I'd rather be seeing them do stuff like that as the main topic of what they're doing than a lot of stuff that they do. The same with the FTA, state organizations, different things like that. They can partner with these other groups to the point where at least we're in the same group. But human nature, since we're tribalist by nature, we want to separate trapping. And, you know, because we're such tribalists, we don't even do that. We separate it between professional trapper and hobby trapper. We separate it between longliners and shortliners, between east and west, between north and south, between land and water trappers, between cow trappers and bobcat trappers, between cow trappers and fox trappers, you know, between mink and, I mean, we do that to ourselves a lot. We break that down, and then we build this little clique or this little tribe where we're okay, and the rest of the trappers, you know, they're not like us. And it doesn't really work. And the hunters do the same thing, you know, and that they but the only way I can really see it to get through these next 10 or 15 years. Now, once we hit the next cycle, guys, hey, we're golden for about 40 years or 20 years. We ain't got to worry about that, because no one's going to care what you're doing. We're going to start getting back into the me part of the upswing, and no one's going to care what you're doing. But right now, everybody would rather be mad and than bored, and they'd rather be activist than bored. So that's where we get a lot of this crap that we get today. And it's going to fall on trappers and deer hunters and everything else to be able to break that out. Now, there's certain segments of the outdoors that really have issues with each other. One is trapping and one is dog hunters. I don't know how you're ever going to break that. I really don't. That's going to be a tough one, you know, but I'm sure it could be done. It's just going to take someone to put a lot more thought in it than probably I have, just because it's so negative that I don't even want to deal with them most of the time. Now, there's guys like Randy Smith that's got one foot in the trapping industry and just as big a foot in the dog industry. And maybe he would have some way to figure this out. I don't know. You know, but it's I guarantee it's going to come down to language, and it's going to come down to we're okay needs each other for this to work better. So, I mean, that's kind of the way I see this is going to have to work. And yeah, there is separations. And, you know, one thing we can do, because we can't change the world. I can't change the world. You can't change the world or anything like that. But there's a phrase in permaculture that I think that trappers need to start thinking about in their daily lives. Be the change you want to see in the world. So if you want outdoorsmen and sportsmen to get together, you have to start the change in your influence, whether that be online or your friends or clubs or your buddies or anything else like that. And the reason that's so powerful is it's not an organization. You don't have bureaucracy in it. And it can spread organically where it means more. Now, most people like me, I know enough deer hunters. When I talk to them about it, most of them now do not look at hunting in any negative way whatsoever. It may not be something they're interested in, but they know that it's a value to them, and they probably would stand up for it. You know, the fishermen around here, when they see me down in the creek fishing, they ask me what I'm doing. You know, most time when I start those conversations, you know, I do some trapping in the winter. And the reason I'm trapping otter is because I would like it to be like it was 15 years ago when we both could wade up and down this the Squatchy River and catch a string full of rock bass. Now see, that is a totally different way than most people would handle that. I'm trapping, I've got a right to, what are you bothering me for, this, that, and the other. I do that all the time. If I see someone that when I'm out cow trapping, the first thing is, you know, the state's not doing anything, federal government's not doing anything, so I figured we got to take care of ourselves, and if we want to have deer, we got to get some of these predators down. Then I'll mention a couple studies and this, that, and the other. And the way that they view that from that point on, I guarantee you, is very different than any other way that they're probably thinking about it before. So the language and be the change that you want to see in the world, even though that sounds hippie-ish, I think it's true. This goes with all aspects of life, really, I think. So I think it's a great topic. I don't really know how to fix this. And I do know that it's going to be harder coming up. And you're going to see this in your own lives, guys. And if you know what it is, since we're talking about it now, and you know what it is, and you start seeing there's more I'm okay, everybody else is wrong type thing, at least you'll know what you're dealing with. And once you know what you're dealing with, you can handle that in a lot more mature manner. You can handle that with some strategic principles when you're talking to somebody, like I do when someone's asking me why I'm setting traps in the water down there. You know, if I'm trapping muskrats down on one of the rivers, and when the landowner comes out and he's all pissed off because he doesn't understand the laws or whatever, why are you doing that? I don't want you here. Why are you doing that? And most of the time, the way I start that conversation, once they blow up, I sit there and let them unwind a little bit. And I'll go, look, you know, I have a legal right to be here, but that's not the main reason I'm doing this. The main reason I'm doing this, have you seen these holes that's going up in your bank? You know, that property that you bought on the river, you're going to be losing footage every year, because when the barges come down this river and the muskrats got these great big holes, or the beaver have these great big holes, it washes them out 40 feet up in there, and you're going to start losing all your ground. You know, and the way that I kind of see it is, as you know, neighbors, we should take care of each other. So I can help you with your land problem, and I don't have to ask you to pay me, because I can sometimes sell the fur and make a little bit of money, so it kind of works both ways. And when you do that, all of a sudden then the person is looking at it from, holy crap, those animals are going to wash away my land. And I've only had a couple of times when I've used that tactic, and that's what it is a tactic, that I was told to leave anyway. I mean, if they're just a staunch anti or whatever, then I may go to, well, you need to call the game board and see what the laws are, because I'm being 100% legal. I wish you didn't feel this way, but just because you're upset doesn't mean that I'm going to leave. You know, it could evolve into that, but most time it doesn't. And then the next time you go down there, if that neighbor talks to another neighbor, all of a sudden he's going to be down on his riverbank, and he's going to see these holes from the muskrats, and he's going to start being worried about it, and he's going to want a trapper. And it gets us more into, we're okay, that group just keeps getting bigger and bigger, but it's our language, and it's how we interact with people, and it's be the change that you want to see in the world. So if you want the outdoorsmen and sportsmen to be together, if each and every one of us would influence several people, you'd be surprised how that would change. You can see it now in the grocery store. The government and regulations don't talk about gluten and everything, but the people that don't want gluten are, we're okay and you're not okay, and they've changed the whole market. The same thing with corn syrup. We're okay, you're not okay. We don't want your corn syrup because it's bad, this, that, and the other. And of course, they're saying it's great for you and all this, and you know it's not. But the organic, with people talking to each other, has changed the whole food industry when it comes to that. And now you'll probably see in the next 3 or 4 years that most soft drinks are going to go back to sugar. You know, and it's just because the market said, I don't want corn syrup, and if you got corn syrup in there, I ain't buying it. You know, and the same process goes with trapping or anything else. The organic movement of stuff happening because people believe in something is a lot stronger than any regulation or law or anything like that. And I think that's where we should be. Now, I've got a question that I'm going to talk a little bit about from Facebook. And it's a gentleman from Utah. And it's gonna, I think if I remember right, it's gonna be the first year he's trapping, and he was asking about setting snares and traps, and should you use them together? Guys, I'm telling you, yes, absolutely, 100%. But there's a couple things to keep in mind here. Setting snares is a different mentality than setting traps. Your locations and the way that you're gonna be looking at the ground a lot of times are gonna be very different. So even though I say yes, I want to caution you on one thing. Don't set them at the same time. You can go back in the archives. We talked about a progressive trap line, and the snare and trap is the same thing. Now, if he's going after coyotes or bobcats, it's pretty irrelevant. It's the same thing. You need to pick which one of these you want to use first. But before we get into that, why would I say yes, use snares and footholds? It's very simple. Snares on a full line will most of the time outproduce traps. Snares over a long term period of having them out are really, they don't care about the weather. So unless you get a freezing rain, it doesn't matter if it snows, it rains, or it's dry. So by using snares and footholds on the same line, guys, you're like hedging your bet. And I've been with people, and I think I've told this story before. When I was taking instruction from Pete Leggett, and we were out there the first day, and we had a red fox set in on this farm, and this little road dead-ended into this barbed wire fence, and it was grown up, and we missed the fox. And me being so used to using snares, when I looked around, there was a wad of red fox hair in that fence that was as big as a golf ball. I mean, they were wearing it out. They're going down that little road. The location for the trap was right. And then right there, it had been really simple to put in a snare. So if you miss the fox at the foothold set, you catch him in the fence. If he's coming the other direction, you catch him in the fence and you still have the foothold set open. So you're hedging your bets in a lot of different ways. But a lot of guys don't do that because they're a foot trapper or they're a snaresman. And like most things, if you're either or, you're probably going to be missing out on the whole picture. So I do like using snares and footholds at the same time, but I don't like setting them at the same time. But the reason I say yes, so if you're in Utah and you start out and it's dry and you're in all that big sage and everything out there and you're putting in foothold sets and then all of a sudden you get dumped a foot of snow, there's a good chance your foothold sets are going to be out of whack. But if you've got out a good number of snares, you're still in the game, man. I mean, that's why you want to do it. If you get a big rain and you got a bunch of dirt holes out, or you know, a really big rain and it's and you're on the, you know, where any water is going to be going downhill and it just takes all your cover off your trap because it's just a monster rain, your snares are still going to be sitting there, you know, like a Navy SEAL team waiting to take whoever comes through there. And that, to me, that's the big advantage of mixing these things up. It's really, really cool when you think about it that way. So absolutely, yes, you're doubling your chances no matter what the weather is, which is awesome. The thing about using traps with snares is traps sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes will catch more animals quicker because you're using bait and lure and visual and stuff like that. So it's kind of like a combination of doing this. But to set them up together, I think, is a dangerous thing, and here's why. When you go to a property and you're looking for travel ways, your locations, however you're trying to figure out where to do it for footholds, you're not looking at the same things you would be for snares. And your mindset's going to be a certain way, and your mindset is going to dictate how that you're going to be setting that line out. Now, if you're thinking you're going to run some snares and something just really jumps out at you like the big wad of fur in Maryland on that fence, yeah, you're going to set the snare, no big deal. So what I like to do is I will look at the weather normally and try to guesstimate, am I going to have decent weather for 4 or 5 days, or is it going to be sucky weather for 4 or 5 days? If it's sucky weather, I start the snare part of it first. So when I go to a property, I'm looking for fences, I'm looking for game trails, I'm looking for high bank trails, everywhere that I would set a snare on the animal that I'm looking for. That's all that's in my head. The only thing that's in my Jeep is snare support, snare, some wire, you know, zip ties, something I may be using on the snare line. That's all I'm thinking about. That's it. You know, like I'm going to be doing a show for F&T coming up. Alan's coming down sometime mid-January, and it's going to be 100% snares. Now, I'm going to use that kind of to my advantage. So me and D, the gentleman I was telling about, the outdoorsman, we're going to have snares set up all up down the valley, and Alan Probst is going to have his tongue hanging out by the end of the day, but we're going to have his footage. Now, when he leaves, all those snares are still going to be there, and depending on distance, I may pull some or whatever. But then I'm going to go into the foothold section if the weather looks like it's just not going to be a monsoon in the next, you know, 36 hours. That's when the coyote line here is really going to be rocking, because I'm going to be catching my footholds and snares. But when I go set those snares for the TV show, the only thing I'm looking at is snare locations. My brain can only, your only brain can only think about one thing really good at one time. Now, you can multitask and stuff, but if you go to a farm and you set out traps and then you go to look, find the snare locations, you're only going to get a couple of farms set in a day, and you're really going to hurt your numbers because you're on such a small amount of ground. But you can go out with just footholds and over 2 or 3 days have 100, 150, or 50, depending on your ground, of footholds out, and then when you're going to check them, make sure that when you're setting these traps up, it's not daylight till dark checking them, but it's like daylight till 1 o'clock. So once I get done checking, I will go back through that line starting on the last one, and then I'm not touching a trap again. Only thing I'm looking at is snares. I automatically switch my brain to looking at snare locations. So instead of looking at bigger travel ways and openings and stuff like that, I'm thinking trails. I get really focused on those trails. And you will see stuff that you'll never see when you're putting out footholds if you're thinking footholds. This is the reason I know this is important. So when I go back through that line or the next day, I will be looking for snare locations and I just happen to be checking traps. So if I get a coyote, I dispatch the coyote, I remake the coyote set. That's just kind of what I have to do in between me setting snares, because that's my goal, is setting snares. And then I go to the next farm, and what you'll find over the next 2 or 3 days is you'll have all your footholds out and all your snares out, and you're really going to be rocking and rolling when it comes to your catching. And then if you get the big rain, then you're just checking snares and you're remaking sets. So you can kind of do one mindlessly once it's in place, but you can't do both of them and do them very well. So that's kind of where I believe that that's such an important thing. Now I'm going to go and we're going to do one last question. And this is a really cool thing.
Hey, right, Clint, it's Jesse. Just want to say thank you for answering our questions on the otter. Really appreciate that. You got me super excited, man. You know, I mean, I got the Des Moines River only 5 miles south from where I live. It's there's a nice, you know, nice road to go up and down that river that's got plenty of feeder creeks and streams and culverts, and it seems like just stack it up, brother, you know. Screw the sign, makes sense to me. And heck, I even got a creek that goes through my property that it's got a lot of beds in it. There's even one pool on my side of the creek where there's you know, catfish live in, and I'm thinking, man, I bet there's some nice channels going to that pool of catfish. That'd be pretty cool. So, and I'm going to try to convince my wife going down the Ozarks with me. She likes trapping with me, which is great. But she snared her first fox last year, caught a couple of coons. So I know she loves it, but she's a homebody. And she's not the type to take things very extreme. She's like, oh, you got your fox, you got your kite, you got a few coons. You should be done soon, right? No, honey, I want to go to 5,000 coon. She says. So the traveling part does not excite her very much, but we'll see. She either come along or I go down there for a little bit. I don't know. I mean, want to keep the missus happy too, you know? So anyway, but yeah, this the whole podcast, I feel a lot more confident in where I can set out. I mean, I don't expect to catch more than one, honestly. I don't, but just to get out there, be fun. Heck, I mean, I don't even have to go clear down to Branson. I'm only a half hour away from Missouri, and the one highway I frequently use, there's some bridges there that they're on some nice creeks, and just got to get down there and check it out, man. You know, their laws are a bit different. No snares. Conner bears are a joke, but doesn't mean I can't put a 280 or 330 underwater and maybe set some blind sets out for footholds. I don't know. See what happens, man. But, you know, I had an idea. I wanted to run by you. This is kind of why I'm doing the recording again. Not just as a thank you, but also, you know, when you talk about blocking and, you know, you got to find sticks and stuff and whatnot to use, I really thought, why couldn't trappers learn to coppice certain trees like willows and have two or three of these trees that are coppice and have plenty of nice shoots and branches that could be used in ready blocking? Like I had, this is my idea to kind of capitalize on this. You have a coppice willow to carry these sticks. What I would do, I would have like an inch and a half to 2 inch size PVC pipe, 2 to 3 feet long. You have a strap on, it's riveted into the pipe, and you have this on your back. You can just carry it where you go, and that way you're not wasting time looking for sticks. Now, willows, I know they can be pretty straight up and down, but I thought, hey, this would be pretty cool to have it as ready-made blocking in regards with otter. Heck, it could be beaver. Even those blind sets for coon that you mentioned before, where you make like an X pattern with sticks. You know, I think willows be pretty discreet, honestly. You just got to trim them down. But, you know, and also, what's interesting about this, Clint, you'll appreciate this, I believe it's stacking a function top of a function, because willows, you can achieve an income off of willows. If you go to profitableplantsdigest.com, it may seem kind of like, okay, this is just some kind of get-rich-quick scheme, but I did fact-check several articles like the mushrooms, and one on garlic, another something or another, I think one on nut-producing trees, and there's a lot of studies from universities that back them up. So the willow thing, I'm not too, and the other ones are true, maybe they're pushing this, but they claim you could probably make about 50 grand a year off an acre of willows, and you just got to market it to the right people. I mean, what I would do, Clint, if trappers are interested in this, they could either coppice trees, and willows are hard to start. I'm going to take an acre of my property and probably plow it up here in a week, till it under because it's Reese Canary, and then just to get the willows a better head start. And what I'm going to try to do is clip a bunch of willows here in a couple weeks and put them in my this little acre patch. And just market it. I won't go in there. Just let them grow because they have their own root hormone that gets them started. Really strong root hormone. So get them started, and then have a website built where it's an on-demand thing. How many, you know, either sell these willows as a planting, you know, like you were mentioning about in your one podcast about the ADC beaver trapping, or market them to furniture makers and basketry stuff. That's a real thing. You know, I mean, there are people that specialize in wicker materials, and most are made out of willows, you know. And that actually, back in the 19th century, that was the main way people made furniture before the Industrial Revolution came about, as I understood it, which is very interesting. And, you know, it's a natural organic product. I mean, what more do you want? And and there's a new thing that's still kind of new, is willows for fuel. Everybody, and you know, you can either, I think a fellow should try this, try taking these willows and burn them in a wood stove and see how much heat they give off. And it's not just a part of, it's just a really nice way to have fuel heat your house, or even if you have a wood burning water heater, that's a great way, a great resource right there. And not only for yourself, but to other people. He's got to market and really show people, hey, willows can be used for fuel. This is how you do it. Now, they're using a mulcher to chip up these willows, but I'm sure there's got to be a way to do this, you know. So, you know, and while we're on the topic of coppicing, I even had another idea. This is kind of going beyond the trapping, but I think you would appreciate this. And maybe you want to share with other trappers. I don't know. I'm not sure you could do this, but I don't see why. And see if it's possible to coppice a Osage orange tree or the hedge trees. Instead of just cutting down the tree and waiting for years to get a few hedge posts, and only get a few hedge posts out of the tree you cut down, why not harvest the hedge, but start training this tree to coppice and maybe produce 5 to 20 hedge posts as the branches, you know, let them grow. And how I would do it is I would do to one of these trees, each a tree every year, until you have a cycle built. Like, say it takes 10 years, let's say it takes 5 years for their branches to be really solid hedge post. So you have 5 trees, and every year you coppice these trees, and then every year you'll have hedge posts growing. And it might not be a lot, but it's a little income stream. Maybe you need to use 5 or 10 of these trees, because here in Southeast Iowa, they're everywhere. Anywhere you find old pasture, there's these hedge trees at. And also my area, there's a dude buying Osage oranges for cosmetics, I believe. So, and he's buying them for $180 a ton. Now, I don't know how many of these fruits one tree produces. I'm not quite sure. But if, let's say one tree produced a quarter of a ton, and you had 20 of these trees, well, that's about 4 to 5 ton. That's about $900. Not very much, but you can use that money to pay for your taxes or emergency fund or whatever, just a little income stream. Doesn't mean the money's got to go somewhere. It can go somewhere as spending. It can go as savings or whatever, you know? So, I don't know. I just thought the idea would be really unique, instead of just cutting all your trees down at once and wait for the next product to come through. And I just brought it up because we're on the topic of coppicing. But let me know if you think that's interesting or not, because the goal as a trapper for me is to save as much time as possible so you can get the next location set it up. And if I have to use a lot of blocking for, you know, otter, for example, I don't want to be stumbling around the creek and, you know, accidentally went out too far and you hit that pool and you know how deep it was and you fell in, you're miserable the rest of the day. And, you know, it'd be nice just to save yourself time and energy and misery by just having these blockage, you know, on your back. So thanks again, Clint. Hopefully I'll have some otter pictures for you. I'm going to try to set up my creek here next weekend. It's getting close, man. It's getting really close. I'm so pumped. But the lower the prices are, the least amount of trappers there are. I'm weird like that. I don't care. But and there's other creek too. And maybe I might venture into Missouri and see if I make it back. I don't know. Thanks again, man. Take care.
I think this is fascinating. If you don't know what compassing is, it's not a compass like you use to find north and south. Compassing is a woodsman's skill. And the first time that I've seen historical data on compassing was in Europe back in the early Middle Ages. And the reason is quite simple, and I don't know why foresters don't do this, but compassing is very simple. There's a lot of trees, willow's definitely one of them, that you can compass. And compass means, it's just a word that's used for a technique where, like for oak trees, for instance, say that you've got a wood stove in your fur shed, or you do like I do, where I heat with wood a lot in the winter here when we do get cold, just because I like playing around with fire more than anything else. But compassing is, if you do it in the true terms of what it means, it would be like white oak, red oak, stuff like that. So you can go to the woods, or you can have a compass section. In permaculture, it's usually in zone 3 or 4, which is far away from your gardens and stuff, something you don't deal with very often. But what it means is you have like a white oak tree, or if you're using hickory for wood, or whatever it is you use for wood in your area, and you will cut that 4 or 5 feet off the ground when it's probably as big as a big fence post. So you'll whack it off at the top in the winter and you'll harvest that wood. And in the spring, it puts out new shoots and it bushes out, and then it'll grow out in this bush-like thing. But over the next 5 or 6 years, you can go back and harvest that same tree again. So it's very different from commercial type forestry where you go in and you cut everything, then you replant. Well, the cycle on certain trees is probably like pine trees, probably 15, 20 years. Oak trees would be more than that. But a compassing system, which is way more efficient, is you let the tree, you don't kill the tree, you let the tree regrow. So that's what the term is. You cut it off, you let it branch out, you let it grow again. Now, I don't have that much experience with Osage Orange, besides I use it for rootstock on Chase Seedless. Now, I'm going to plant some down on the farm as a block between me and another property, because if you've never dealt with Osage Orange, it's got some really nasty thorns in it, but it is the hardest wood that I've ever played with. I mean, it's kind of dangerous for a chainsaw, and I've talked to some old timers and they say it's like in spring you cut it or something because it's the way the sap is, but it's like really hard. It's a lot harder than oak or anything like that. It's makes great fence posts and different things like that. So yeah, I'm sure you can compass that because it's such a hardy tree. Because the Chase Seedless that I tried to move out of my yard over to the farm, I've got Osage Orange growing in my yard now. I mean, you can't kill the dang thing. So you can see that. Now, when he's talking about doing it for trapping, I love this idea. I'll be honest with you. I love this idea. This is like playing master chess trapping. This is freaking awesome. And I've tried this and I've had mixed results, but it was probably because of what I was trying to do. And I don't know that much about bamboos. But we have a plant here, and it's all over the South. It's called river cane. It looks like bamboo everybody uses for beam posts and stuff like that. But it normally only gets, a big one is like an inch round, and most of them are going to be a half inch. And it looks just like bamboo, and they grow in clumps. And I like using it for blocking of otter and beaver, because if you cut it off towards the top, it's got the bushy bamboo leaves. It's green all year. And it just hides. You stick down one on each side of the trap, it breaks out the outline. It's beautiful. I mean, it's like a Picasso when you're out beaver and otter trapping. So that's awesome. And I tried to transplant that where the where I know that I always have beaver and otter runs, and some of them have worked and it's been very handy, which is why I think it's such a cool idea. Some of it didn't. Now that's a harder thing. Bamboos are harder to get started than most plants. Now using willow is genius. And another plant you can look at is autumn olive or Russian olive. And whenever your biologist, and they, it's invasive species, tell them to go pound sand because they don't know nothing about nature. But that's a plant you could also use to do this. And those two plants have a very unique characteristic to them that makes this easier. So why would you want to do this? Let's say that if you're not, you know, one of these fire-breathing, dragon-chasing state hoppers that go all over the place, and you're trapping in your home area most of the time, this is where it's master chest plan as a trapper. You can use this in two different ways. Willow and autumn olive, and I believe Russian olive is the same way. And you could probably do research and find, I know another one they use for this is ginkgo, but that's a slow growing tree, so I wouldn't use it. And the other one is yellow twig dogwood. And I don't know how far north that goes, so you're gonna have to keep that in mind. But the reason I know about these plants, it's we talked about in the past where if you're doing beaver control, you could also have a side business where you do stream bank containment where you can plant these trees. And the way you do it is you go find a willow and they grow along water, you know, for otter and beaver, it's perfect. And, you know, like here, even on the mountaintops, if there's a creek there, we've got willow. If it's on the river, there's willow. It grows up anywhere there's a wet spot, and it's a tremendously fast growing, just like an autumn olive is. They both love water. They're very thirsty plants. Which brings up a point for you, Jesse. If you're going to try to put an acre of willow in, you need to figure out a watering system through swales or key line design or irrigation or something, because if you want to get them to really get booming, they're going to need a lot of water. And you know, you can look up key line or swales or something like that, or flood irrigation if you got any way that you can get water to the top of your property and flood the bottom part through channels over your trees. You're not going to hurt either one of these. But out in the wild, you can go out and you can literally take inch pieces, 3/4 inches up to probably 2 inches with just a pair of pruners, snippers, and cut them in 2-foot sections. Now, what you got to do what I'm getting ready to say to make it work, a tree's got a root side and a leaf side. So if you start cutting up these willows, you got to have a pattern. And what most people that do this, they cut it flat on the top and a 45 degree angle on the bottom. So the root side is always the 45 and the flat side is always the top of the willow. And they'll cut thousands of these a week. And they do this in the wintertime when it goes dormant. And then they do these contracts. And these are like, some of these are multi-million dollar contracts on riverbanks and creeks and stuff like that. And then they go out there and they get a pack basket, basically. And they've got these sticks. They trimmed all the leaves off. So it looks like a trapping stake. It's the bottom side where the roots are is cut on an angle and the top is flat. And then they go out and they just walk the creek, and every 5 or 6 foot, they push this willow down in the mud where it's about halfway in the mud. Most of the time when you see these things, they're 2 to 3 feet tall. They push them in the mud. Now, as soon as spring comes, they start putting out roots because willow does have the hormone inside of it. And it'll start putting off limbs and leaves, and you'll have, in 2 years, you'll have a 15-foot tree next to any type of water. I mean, it is a fast-growing tree. Now, one tree that I would like to see someone play around with this, because I'm definitely going to put them out, I'm going to sneak across my property, and I'm going to put some mulberry trees next to that other property to see how they react in water. It won't work on my side as well, but it's more sloping on the other side, and I can walk across it most of the time. Is you can put in, you can do willow, basically the same thing. Now you cut those right when the buds start to swell in the spring, and you go stick them in the ground, and if they're moist, they're gonna grow a tree. Now a mulberry is a softer wood, which would be easier to cut. It's like willow. And it has an advantage where you can stack functions. Now, you can go and pick the mulberry fruit, which is delicious. Or you can use it to feed the fish when no one's there to know what you're doing. So, you know, you can use this as even a further stacking a function of an outdoor system. You can go cut mulberry, put them out over fishing holes, and they put on fruit for a long time, and fish love it. They absolutely love it. That's one of the things permacultures do to feed fish in ponds. They put mulberry around the edge of them. But whether you're using autumn olive or willow or mulberry, which I think all of those work very well, you got to be more specific. When you cut the mulberry, it needs to be right before the buds start coming open and they're swelling in the springtime. But you can do this in two different ways, which I think this is cool. I don't know how much water a willow can stand, but I would definitely be trying this. And I think I'm going to try this. I got a few places it's popping in my mind that I'm going to do this. This winter, I'm going to cut willow and I'm going to go stick them in where they're normally in a boggy area, which the willows love. But sometimes they're going to be underwater, which I don't think is going to hurt them. But I'm going to set them where they're going to be like 18 inches apart where there's always beaver runs. So I'm going to put two trees in the run, 18 inches, 20 inches apart inside of the run of the beaver. Now, there's a chance the beaver's going to eat the willow, and that's a chance you're going to have to take. But it'll keep resprouting. And the reason that I want it to do that, once it gets roots, the beaver can cut it and it'll grow right back. They're coppicing anyway when it comes to something like that. But the reason to do that, because some of these places it's pretty wide open, and if I could use the willow trunk, even if it's a couple inches or 6 inches, all I would have to do from that point on is just stick a conibear in front of it or put a foothold in between it or a snare, either one, didn't make any difference. So I can have permanent blocking at beaver and otter locations. Now, the reason I really like the idea of the mulberry for this, probably more than the willow if I'm thinking otter. There's a lot of places, like we were talking about with the otter for you, Jesse, you got the chutes or the channels where they go from pond to pond. If you were to put on the public side and the public bank, and I'm sure there's some type of laws we're breaking, and I really don't care. But if you were to plant some mulberries down there and you coppice them after the first year, and if you don't know what that means with a mulberry, you can have a mulberry that's as big as your pinky and 18 inches long. In 1 year, it's 9 foot tall and has limbs going everywhere. So you've got all the blocking material and the material to support your conibear right there. Plus, but for otter, I think you can train the otter, because when the mulberries come on and they produce in just a couple of years, and after 4 or 5 years, they get really, really productive. Those fish, it's going to be like an automatic catfish feeder that 99.9% of people that go by are not going to know they can even eat the fruit or what you're doing. And you're going to be feeding the fish. And I think the otter will automatically, over time, get used to more fish being there because there's food during that time. So they're always going to check it. So you're going to get even more otter going to that place than you would otherwise. And that's freaking cool. I mean, that is cool when you think about it like that. Now, you can do the same thing with willow. Absolutely. If you're in high beaver areas, you need to plant a lot because they're going to eat a lot. But they will come back unless they just hammer them to death. You know, that's the only negative about doing this. I personally really like the idea of having it where I can put permanent blocking in places. And I'm starting to think about this from listening to your little thing, Jesse. Take it a little bit further. There's places I can think of in my mind right now that if you go look at my YouTube channel, you'll see where I'm carrying snaring coyotes. And it's right up under the road. And there's these trails that come out and hook into a field. And I think I catch like 2 or 3 coyotes in one day there. So you'll know which one it is. Or it could be on Trapping Radio. Trapping TV. I'm not sure. But you can go back and find it. Now, that trail that comes out of that field is I always have to block it up because it's nothing but some briars. It's green in the summertime. Then everything falls back in the wintertime and it's really open and I've got to do some work. Now, why can't I take a willow or autumn olive, which is basically the same thing? If it's moist in the spring and you stick it in there, you're going to have an autumn olive growing there. Don't worry about seeds. Just cut it off and put it in there. If you don't have luck with that, drive around in the spring and learn what an autumn olive is, and you can see the flowers in the springtime. And what I do for my farm now, because chickens love the autumn olive berries and it gives them protection from hawks, is I'll just go and dig any autumn olive up that's, you know, 12 inches to 4 feet, and if it's in boggy water, it doesn't take me any time. I just go plant them, and I've got healthy bushes. So whether it's willow or whatever, or autumn olive or mulberry, because those are something that really works good, you could go and set those on both sides of that trail, probably, you know, about 2 feet apart. And then for the next 5 or 6 years, you've got the most amazing blocking that you've ever seen, because it's 100% natural. Once it gets bigger, you can just wire off to it. You know, and I mean, think about how cool that is. Use compassing inside of your trapping. Coon trails, you got high bank trails, it's there year after year, but it's just low grass and stuff like that. And you got to do a lot of work to really hide your conibear. Plant two things on both sides and let it grow up. The coon aren't gonna change their pattern, because you got two autumn olives, willows, or something like that growing on each side. And then you automatically, from then on, you've got your conibear. And all you'd have to do, because if you use willow, is have some hand pruners with you. You go in, you put your you snip off some willow to run down through the springs of your conibear. You can block it down, plus you've got the side blocking. I mean, that's freaking awesome. And that's like super chess playing a trapper's that most trappers will never think of, because they think so far into the box. I mean, this is really cool, all the advantages of doing that. And y'all know I love business. And I love the idea that if you did this over a couple of counties, and you could go through in the summer or spring and trim them up and sell the product off of your blocking, I mean, that's like orgasmic for a trapper to think about something like that. That's really, it is. It's orgasmic to think about that. The stacking of functions of something like that. If you're using mulberries, you could take those to a farmer's market and give free taste tests, and as many as you can bring, you're going to sell. There's no pesticides, completely natural. It's wild forage food, even though you planted it. People will fall all over that. Talk about look at the nutritional value of it. Talk about juicing it. If you can't sell them all, freeze it, sell it later for people that want to juice. I mean, that is where a trapper using his head can have so many advantages over most people that it is just absolutely boggles the mind. And if there's that big of a market for, I mean, I've never thought about willows for furniture making, but I see them all over the place. I knew they were willows. And if you don't want to sell them to, because I'm sure it's by the pound, and there's probably all kind of stipulations to what they want and stuff like that, which probably is not hard to get around. But think about it from your own point of view. If you've got a beaver hide, when beavers bring in $5 a piece, and you're growing all this willow all over the place, and you can go out and cut a limb and bend it because it's flexible, make your own hoop, get you some leather, and after you get a tanned hide, and string that thing up there, you just took a tanned hide of a beaver that's probably worth $50, with $2 worth of leather and a free piece of willow hoop, you just turn that into a $150 decoration. Now you're beaver trapping. You're not catching $5 beaver anymore. Now you're catching a $5 beaver, putting $18 to get it tanned, and you got $150 profit. Or product. Not profit, but product. That's the American dream right there. I mean, that really is the American dream. Now, one thing I would say with the willows is I would definitely have it where you would sell some as a nursery stock. I would definitely, with the Osage Orange, and if anybody's out there and you're kind of confused, I want you to run the numbers. My property that I bought is 13 acres. For me to run a chicken fence all the way around my property, where I can keep chickens and ducks in and keep predators out for the most part, is very expensive. Now, when someone buys a property and they want to put a horse, or they know that in the future they want to put a horse, a business idea that wouldn't be that hard to get traction, I have no doubt whatsoever, especially with Osage Orange. Autumn olives are not the best thing because they have a lot of open space at the bottom. Hedges of any kind that especially are thorny. You could easily have a business where you're like the hedgerow guy, and if you look at why you would want to plant hedges over barbed wire fence, it's so clear the advantage is the hedge. Because I want you to think about something. If on my place, now when I bought the property, it had telephone poles in because the guy was an electrician. I think he was borrowing them from work. So I've got like a barbed wire fence that's set up for Cape Buffalo and bison right now. But for me to run a chicken fence, because that's what I want to do is pasture raise chickens and ducks. For me to run a chicken fence around that 13 acres, that's very expensive. Plus to have a pen in the middle. Now, if I get Osage Orange and I get the seeds and I plant those in seeds where they're about 12 inches apart, and then I trim them at the height that I want to have for the top of the hedgerow, I can have an impermeable hedgerow that is cheaper than putting in a barbed wire fence, and it'll be in place within 2 to 3 years. So when you look at people that have cows, and they're running no telling how much space. And to run a nursery on something like this, guys, is not hard. You get Osage Orange. You get the seeds out of that big nasty pod and it smells funky as crap. And you take those out and you clean them off. And then in a 10 by 10 area, you can probably grow 10,000 Osage Orange saplings. Go out in the fall if you're not up far winter. Plant them in the ground, which you can also charge to do for somebody where they want their property line is and this, that, and the other. In a couple of years, for what you would charge them to do that would not be anywhere near what we're running a big fence is for something like that. And there ain't a horse or a cow or anything that's going to go through an Osage Orange hedgerow. There ain't a person that's going to sneak on your property and sneak through that thing to go deer hunting. If they do, they'll be laying on the other side and you'll need to medevac them out because they're not going to have any blood left. That's how dense and strong these things grow if you grow them, you know, a foot apart or 24 inches apart or something like that. Now, if you've already got hedgerows where you're at, where the Osage Orange, you can get tens of thousands of seeds. They grow really easy. They pop out of the ground. They're tough as nails and you can go do that. You know, I don't know if I'd be using Osage Orange for compensating for trapping, because that is a hard freaking wood. I mean, it really is. But as far as the fence post, if you could go out and this is what in permaculture we call guerrilla gardening. And I'm sure most of y'all have heard that term. I could easily go out on the river and put out tens of thousands of saplings on the river where they'll somewhat stay moist. No one's going to know what they are. I could compass them. I could do it out of a canoe. I could do it, which to me is even stacking more functions because it's less labor. But I could have a fence post business built on the side of public ground and nobody would know it. And I wouldn't even have to own the land. And I could go in there and cut fence posts and sell them all day long. There's no doubt about that whatsoever. Fence posts are expensive. Now, what does it cost you to grow a fence post? Well, I mean, one of those nasty things of an Osage Orange that smells like, I mean, it's like old people's perfume it's like way too strong. I mean, it's nasty. But you break them open, you clean the seeds, you plant them out, you go plant them out, and then probably 3 or 4 years, you compost it, and then a couple of years after that, you're going to have a smaller fence post, and if you wait a couple more years, you'll have a big fence post. And this is where not thinking like a heathen, where you're thinking only short term but long term, you can have a full-time business supplying fence posts of the best wood that's not going to rot, yada, 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 all that type stuff. And, you know, it's not going to interfere with your trapping or do anything else. And I love the idea about the willow for the furniture building. You know, I don't know. To me personally, Jesse, I mean, if you can put an acre in and you can keep it watered and wet, if you got a boggy area, that's a perfect place to something to do with a piece of property like that. You know, if you can find a market for the willow to do that, shoot, yeah, I'd knock, why wouldn't you? I definitely would. I mean, if there's a market there and it's real and you could just go out there and cut it, I mean, you're probably only talking your investment on that time, probably to plant them 5 or 6 days, a week, and then you're going to come back and cut them. You'll spend a couple of days cutting them and however the market wants them. And then you just take a troller load off and get money. I mean, that's awesome. I mean, that going back like to the first question about the outdoorsman, this is like set up to be an outdoorsman. It really is. But it's not the way that most people think today, because they think wealth comes from going to get a job. Wealth comes from natural products. It always has, and it always will. For normal people. Now, not everybody's going to start a Facebook or a Google. But anybody can go out and start willows. If you find a market for it, it's really cool. There's probably a lot of different things like this that you could do to really gain a lot of extra income. And this is what, when you go back to the older days when they were talking about outdoorsmen, this was woodsmanship. You know, when you go up to Michigan, there's still guys that cut all the wreaths that you see in the stores are coming from places like that. They go out and cut wreaths. They sell them wholesale. They could make them themselves. They got reef makers. They got all this type of stuff. And if you really wanted to bounce your income, run those numbers against the stock market. And please tell me a logical reason why you think the stock market's better than that. You can't. I don't care how big of an education with how many PhDs, somebody that works in the investment industry, they cannot do that, because your income is your biggest way to build your wealth. And the way that you find different ways to build your income doesn't have to be 80 hours a week. Growing willows could be it. And the benefit is that it can make your trapping easier. I mean, that's really cool, dude. I mean, that really is. You've got me super excited about doing this. Because I can tell you, there's several places in my mind for coon, coyotes, beaver, and otter. I'm going to be cutting willows and putting those pegs in the ground, and I'm going to see what happens. And if the market is there, I will go full bore where I can go out of a canoe or whatever, or out of a boat, and I can be beating these things in. For one, I'm going to be helping my neighbors because I'm going to be stabilizing their banks. They're not going to care. And two, I've got a profitable product that no one's even going to know that I've got a farm probably stretched out all across the Tennessee River, and it's none of their business anyway. And I can take my 18-foot John boat and I can fill it up with whatever it is the market wants, and then I can sell it and put the money back into, like you say, pay taxes, go on vacation, buy more trapping equipment, bury it in the backyard, whatever you want to do with it, buy ammo, that's always a good investment, stuff like that. But that's really cool, man. And if you don't know a whole lot about compassing stuff, look it up online, you'll see it. It's not difficult. If they could figure it out in the Middle Ages, you can figure it out today. And if one other thing I want to say before we close about this. If you're burning wood for anything and you're cutting down trees, I have to really question your rationale. Why are you doing that? You've got a root system in the ground that's producing a product and you're going to kill it? That doesn't make any sense. That's not a hippie thing. That just doesn't make any sense. So, like, I've already picked out trees on my new farm that are going to be coppiced. They're hardwood. They're somewhat small right now. They're only about as big as my wrist. And then in a couple of years, I'm going to cut them about 6 feet off the ground. And I'm going to let them bush out. Now, the reason I want to do that, so when I heat my home with wood, all I've got to do out there, I've got a permanent source for probably 20 years before you kill that root system, of I'm going to have wood over and over and over again. And I can do that in several different stages, because I'm not going to cut everything at one time. So they're constantly going to be growing, and you can do that. So if you're spending electricity, if you're thinking, okay, you know, I don't know what to do this, or you don't have a lot of land or whatever, and you're burning wood in your fur shed or your house or your shop or whatever like that, learn what composting is, because it's a woodsman's skill that everybody needs. And then you can see how it works, and then you can get a plan where, you know, every 8 years you've got all the wood that you'll ever want from the same tree. There's no reason to cut it. And it's just such a better deal. I don't know why pulpwood people don't do this. I really don't. I don't know if pines compass. I've never heard anybody doing that or trying that. But for hardwoods, I have no idea why you cut a tree down at the base. It just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And, you know, if you had that compass stuff the way Jesse's talking about carrying your blocking with you, when you cut your limbs off, you got all the blocking in the world you need to do something like that. So yeah, I think it's a great idea, Jesse, and I hope people play around with doing this, because one, it gets people more in tune with nature, and it gets people more in tune with their own revenue streams, and it's just a more enjoyable life. Because the thing with business, guys, everybody wants the big lick. You know, we are a big lick society, and that's a downfall to America. No one wants to do anything unless it's just like a massive load of money comes. That ain't worth my time. Let me tell you, you get five or six things that are $10,000 a piece, that's $50,000. That's a big lick. You get five or six things that are $20,000, now you're talking really, really, really white collar money. And you can do that without working 40 hours a week. You can do that without having the man tell you what to do, and you do stuff that you don't want to do. That's why I like stuff like this so much, because I want to be the man with me and not outsource my revenue to everybody else. So happy Veterans Day, everybody. If you were in the military, if you're not, make sure that you tell somebody that you appreciate what they've done. You know, y'all guys that are already trapping, I'm really jealous, but we're going to be catching up with you real soon. And y'all have a good week, guys.
They say art imitates life, and sometimes life imitates art. But she was 6'3", she could bench press me. Like a young Charlie Pride. As she walked up to you, said, "Honey, how do you do? I know you ain't here with this guy, 'cause there's a bull dyke hitting on my girlfriend. Now I was about to get rowdy and mad. I just kept hearing the words of my dad. She bought you a drink, wrote her phone number down on your hand. She was well on her way, she just hit second base. Not about damn had all I could stand, 'cause there's a bull dyke hitting on my girlfriend. And I was about to get rowdy and mad, but I just kept hearing the words of mine.